The Guardian. Scientists have been digging up clues about the origins of humans for centuries. There have been great efforts to figure out how we, and the world in which we live, have ended up as we are today. Remains from human species continue to come to light. And recently, new scientific techniques have even helped us to analyse ancient DNA from specimens like Cheddar Man, the Mesolithic skeleton discovered in 1903 in Cheddar Gorge in England. But while fossilised skulls and bones are exciting, one of the greatest clues, it seems, is right under our noses.
Teeth are essentially ready-made fossils. They are the most commonly preserved types of fossils we have because they're 98% mineral. They're basically rocks.
So what do we know about how human teeth have evolved over time?
We start out 4 million years ago with large flat teeth, but then there's this sort of evolutionary fork in the road about 2.5 million years ago.
And what kinds of insights do we get about our evolution when we look at teeth found in people across the world today? I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
So, I study human evolution, and more specifically, I reconstruct the diets of our ancient ancestors.
This is Peter Unger. He's a distinguished professor of anthropology and director of the Environmental Dynamics Program at the University of Arkansas in the United States. He's been traveling the world to talk about his new book, Evolution's Bite. We discussed his research into teeth. I started by asking him what makes teeth so special for archaeologists.
Well, actually, teeth are essentially ready-made fossils. They are the most commonly preserved types of fossils we have because they're 98% mineral. They're basically rocks. And so we've got more teeth than we have any other kinds of fossils. And not only that, but teeth are also the best elements that we have for reconstructing diet in the fossil record because they're the only parts of the digestive system that actually preserve, and certainly the only parts of the body that are preserved that actually come into contact with food. And so we can learn a great deal from teeth because they're a bridge to diet in the past.
And let's just start with something very basic here in some ways, which is, why do we have teeth? What do teeth do? Besides, I mean, you know, we all know about cutting and chewing and things, but just talk me through sort of what it is about teeth that's so important for us as animals.
Teeth first evolved about 500 million years ago, and they gave our early vertebrate ancestors an advantage over those jawless fish that didn't have teeth. They're especially important for mammals because mammals do something which is very different from what any other animal does, which is to chew. And chewing allows you to break food into little pieces, which means that you can extract more energy from that food because you can digest it more efficiently. Now, that's important because we are fairly unique. Well, birds as well, but we're fairly unique in being endotherms. That is, we generate our body heat from within, right? So we've got this furnace that's constantly burning energy, and it has to be constantly supplied.
Now let's talk about one of the key aspects of your research. You developed computer models of teeth to allow you to look at the landscapes, like people develop computer models of geographical landscapes. Why was that such an important step forward?
Well, it was an important step forward because before that, the way people characterized teeth was to look at specific landmarks or points on a tooth surface. They would say, okay, the distance between these two cusp tips or these cusp tips in this fissure is X or Y or Z. But the problem with that is that teeth wear down and the landmarks disappear as those teeth wear. Teeth are constantly changing, so you need a way of looking at whole surfaces does not depend on the measurement of individual landmarks that move. And so modeling teeth as landscapes, the cusps become mountains, the fissures become valleys. That's sort of a way of looking at teeth, of characterizing teeth, that works whether the teeth are worn or unworn.
As Peter explained, the landscapes of teeth can help to give us insights into different animals and humans. You are what you eat, as they say. And this, in turn, gives us clues about various species that existed long ago.
It also tells us something about how those species interacted with their environment, which informs our understanding of what the world was like at a time a particular species existed. But on their own, are these clues of diets found in teeth enough to help scientists distinguish between species?
If we can define species by their place in nature, which we do, and diet is a very big part of that, because different species have specific diagnostic characteristic teeth, oftentimes we can use diet to separate species. We look, for example, at living species of chimpanzees and orangutans and gorillas. We can clearly distinguish them on the basis of their teeth. And as we can do that, we can also distinguish most, if not all, of our ancestors that way as well.
Are there any controversies in that area? Are there some hot debates where people say they're the same and other people say no, they're not? Or
absolutely, absolutely. And that depends about your philosophy on how you define species. And I think the problem is not in the power of teeth to distinguish species, but in our inability to define species at all. Charles Darwin argued that they were arbitrary constructs. And because of that, it becomes very difficult to necessarily distinguish species on the basis of diet. That said, pigeonholing each of the individual teeth in one or the other is not a trivial task. Some people will say, tooth A belongs in species 1 and tooth B belongs in species 2. And other people will say, no, they're both in species 2. So we can know, wow, there's a lot of variation in this big bag of teeth. But when it actually comes time to separate them out, not everybody's going to agree on which ones go where.
I wanted to know more about the relationship between teeth and diet. For instance, does our diet determine the structure of our teeth? Or do our teeth determine what we can eat in our diets?
I've never been asked that. I think that our teeth have to be capable of breaking down the sorts of foods that we eat. And those individuals that have teeth that are better suited to a specific food are going to be selected for. That's the way evolution works. And their teeth are going to be passed on from generation to generation. So I think it's sort of a feedback loop.
Now, one of the key things that you talk about in the book is about how you want to look at teeth to explore diets, not just of animals that are alive today, but also of our own ancestors. And as part of that, you sort of started to look at various animals, including brown lemurs and ringtails, and looking at how their diets are reflected in their teeth. Talk me through what you found, because it wasn't as simple as we might like to think. Is that right?
Sure. It actually wasn't my research. It was the research of Bob Sussman, who's recently passed away. He was from Washington University in St. Louis. And he was among the first, if not the first, researchers to go and try and understand how different species of primates could all live together without one competing the other into extinction. And his big question was, well, what allows them to live together? So he sort of developed this interesting experimental design where he chose three sites on Madagascar, one that had brown lemurs, one that had ringtail lemurs, and one that had both. And by studying the lemurs in these three sites, he was able to determine whether their diets just differed naturally or whether they forced their diets apart and divvied up the forest essentially when they were together. What he found was that their diets differed in similar ways whether they lived together or whether they were separate, which led him to presume that the fact that their diets differed in the first place was what allowed them to live together, rather than them having the same diet to start with and just sort of divvying things up.
But what's interesting is that they have very similar teeth. Is that not the case?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That was a head scratcher for him. Basically, what happened was he found that the brown lemurs ate more leaves and the ring-tailed lemurs ate more fruits. But the two species had the same diet compositions, the same menu, as it were. They all ate fruits and leaves and insects and bark and flowers, but they just did so in different proportions. And what he and his colleagues came up with was the idea that perhaps it's not what you eat on average that drives what your teeth look like, but sort of what the most challenging food is that drives that. And since leaves were the most challenging for both, even though one ate leaves rarely and the other ate leaves commonly, that would show up in the fossil record if you found these two species in the fossil record, you'd say, huh, they've got the same diet. But in fact, they really don't. So that is a cautionary tale for paleontologists looking at teeth and trying to reconstruct diet.
So this is an interesting point. Is it the case then that by looking at remains, by which we mean teeth here, that you can't really tell what that individual ate on a day-to-day basis then? Or is that somehow encoded in the wear and tear rather than the shape of the teeth?
Well, what the shape of the teeth and the size of the teeth and the structure of the teeth and all of the things about your teeth that you get from your parents and their parents and their parents can tell you is what an animal is capable of eating, not what it eats on a daily basis. In order to figure out what it eats on a daily basis, you need a different tool. You need what I termed food prints, which are kind of like footprints in the sand, traces of actual activities of once living animals. And there are several different types of food prints. You can look at the chemistry of the teeth, which reflects the foods that were eaten when the teeth were formed, the raw materials. You can look for little bits of food stuck in the tartar. That occurs fairly rarely, but it does occur on occasion. Or you can look at the scratches and pits that form on the teeth as a result of their use, what is called microwear. And that's sort of the main focus of a large chunk of my research.
As Peter mentions, studies into the diets of two different species of lemurs gave researchers some new insights into the relationship between the structure, the capability, and the use of teeth. It also helped to show us what we can and what we can't infer from teeth. Indeed, evidence suggests that the type of teeth we have may represent the range of foods we can potentially eat rather than what actually is eaten on a daily basis. Food prints, as Peter calls them, are better for determining what might have caused the day-to-day wear and tear on the teeth. So in coupling research into both living and extinct animal species, as well as ancient humans, what have we learned about our ancestors?
When you combine tooth shape, microscopic tooth wear, tooth chemistry, you can actually start to say some really interesting things.
And how are modern eating habits changing the structure of our teeth now?
From the perspective of dentistry or dental anthropology, I think there's something to be said about a mismatch between diet and teeth.
More on that when we return after this short break.
Hi, Daniel Glazer here. Our latest episode of A Neuroscientist Explains looks at the fine line that divides perception and hallucination.
I think it would be impossible for us to perceive or to see anything unless we also had the ability to hallucinate. It's the same mechanisms. The brain has hypotheses about what's out there in the world, and perceptions, different kinds of perceptions, are these different hypotheses.
To have a listen, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search A Neuroscientist Explains on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we learned about why archaeologists find teeth so fascinating. Professor Peter Unger took us through what researchers have learned about early man and other species through their teeth. Peter also explained how food prints offer clues as to what people ate on a day-to-day basis. But what does this information about diets really tell us about the ancient world that our ancestors lived in? One key point in Peter's research is how a change in climate could have been linked to changes in diet and therefore changes in patterns we see in teeth. I asked him to expand on that.
Paleontologists, and actually all evolutionary biologists, believe that to one degree or another, climate change drives evolution. I also introduce in the book this concept of the biospheric buffet. I envision the biosphere, that part of our planet that harbors life, as a sort of giant buffet. Animals will belly up to the sneeze guard with their plates in their hands, and they'll pick and choose from whatever's available to them at a given time and a given place. Teeth are important because they're the utensils you have with which to eat. So they're going to limit what you can eat. But there's a lot more to it than that. There's availability, right? In different environments, in different habitats, there are different foods available. Nature swaps foods in and out of this biospheric buffet. And when the climate changes, so too do the habitats, and plates are swapped on this big old buffet table that animals have to choose from. And so the basic idea behind this is that since you can define a species on the basis of its diet in large part, when available foods change, the animals have to adapt to whatever it is that they're forced to pick and choose, and that changes the animals.
And has this approach of coupling teeth with climate changed the way we think about past climates? Have we found new clues as to what ancient climates might have been like?
So it's not so much reconstructing climate, although you can to a degree. So for example, we can look in the fossil record, reconstruct the diets of animals at different times, different levels, see what it is that they ate, and use that to help reconstruct climate, along with all kinds of other different tools that we use to reconstruct diet. And they all put together a complementary picture.
Talk me through what this kind of research is telling us about our ancestors.
Well, it looks like, based on the microscopic patterns of wear, that our ancestors from about 4 million years ago onward show a trend toward increasingly broad diets. What you can tell by looking at microscopic wear is whether they ate hard foods or soft foods, tough foods or brittle foods. And human evolution really begins with the consumption of soft foods, probably forest fruits and the like. But then over time, you start to see the incorporation of more hard, brittle foods, perhaps abrasive foods, that you would expect to find on an open savanna. But they'll still take a lot of softer and tougher foods. And what we see is when we look at the microscopic wear, with reasonable samples of human ancestors, a greater and greater range of microwear patterns over time, over the past 4 million years, that indicates a broadening of our diet, more versatility or flexibility to what we eat.
And is it just the microwear that changes, or is it the actual type of teeth we have?
We start out about 4 million years ago with large flat teeth, and they, over time, start to become bigger and flatter. But then there's this sort of evolutionary fork in the road about 2.5 million years ago, where the teeth actually start to get smaller, the enamel starts to get thinner, and the teeth start to get a little sharper. And that is consistent with an enhanced ability to consume perhaps tough foods, including meat. And when you add to that the fact that stone tools start to show up in the archaeological record, that suggests a broadening of the subsistence base as well. So it's not just the microwear, but the tooth shape also suggests a change in diet, although tooth shape alone can't tell us anything about how broad the diet was.
Anthropologists have been able to show us how some prehistoric men probably looked. Their hands were much like our hands. Somehow these men learned to use their hands to grasp objects. A stone could be used as a simple tool. A stick could be handled as a simple weapon.
Now, especially after the Stone Age and so on, we started using more and more tools in processing and changing what we ate. Does that make it harder to deduce diet from the teeth of human species, given this growing use of tools?
Yes, because teeth are tools to fracture foods. They reflect the properties of those foods. Tools change the properties of foods, right? So if, for example, you pound meat, you're going to soften it. If you pound nuts, you're going to crack them so the teeth don't have to. So that changes the properties of the foods that come into contact with the teeth themselves. That said, we certainly still have some clues. And perhaps the tools is what explains, in part, the smaller and thinner enameled teeth over time. And when you talk about tools, you have to also talk about cooking. And that's going to change the properties of the foods as well.
Some of them took shelter in caves. And in some way, they had made one of the greatest discoveries of man. They had learned the use of fire.
Throughout my conversation with Peter, we discussed how things like the use of tools can affect how we interpret wear and tear of teeth. So do teeth tell us both everything and nothing? How useful are they really in unpicking our past?
You know, I think teeth are actually really quite useful. And as we learn more and we develop more and more techniques, we're able to say more. So the reality is when you combine tooth shape, microscopic tooth wear, tooth chemistry, the little particles of food that occasionally accumulate in the tartar on teeth, you can actually start to say some really interesting things. Like, for example, there are some cases with our near-human cousins where their teeth don't match the food prints on the teeth, don't match what we expect them to be based on the shapes of the teeth. And what's really interesting is that the different types of food prints that are completely independent of one another, like the chemistry of the teeth and the wear of the teeth, match one another, but they don't match the shapes of the teeth. For example, there's a species called Paranthropus boisei, the Boise's near human. And Paranthropus boisei has big flat teeth you'd expect of a nutcracker. On the other hand, when you look at the scratches and pits on the teeth, there are no pits. They're wispy scratches, which suggests they weren't crushing nuts, but they were grinding tough vegetation. When you look at the chemistry of the teeth, the chemistry matches the chemistry of grass and not nuts. So it looks like both the chemistry and the microware are telling you that despite the fact that these guys look like nutcrackers, they weren't cracking nuts at all.
One of the things that you talk about is whether changes in teeth always suggest a change in diet, as in terms of changing the shape of the teeth, or whether it could be down to perhaps those teeth evolving just to do a job better. Is that a difficult thing to interpret when you see these changes in the fossil record?
Yes and no. One would expect through evolution, animals to become more efficient at whatever it is that they do, whether there's really environmental change or not, because part of their environment are other animals and they're competing with them. They're prey and predators. The classic example is the wolf and the hare, right? The wolf has to constantly evolve to become faster to get the hare. The hare has to evolve to become faster to escape the wolf. And over time, both get faster, both get more efficient at running. The same might be true of teeth. You become progressively more efficient over time at eating whatever it is that you have to eat.
I asked Peter how important this flexibility was to our success as humans.
Well, I think critical. If you look at the distribution of mammals across the globe today, there's only one other type of mammal that has the kind of geographic spread that we do, rats. And that's because they followed us, right? The fact that we are able to earn a living in the high Arctic and on the equator and down into the sub-Antarctic is largely because we're capable of finding something to eat on all of this planet's myriad biospheric buffets. And that's only because evolution has pretty much sculpted us, has selected for us to be flexible in terms of our diets. I think that's probably the key to our evolutionary success.
One of the key things you talk about as well is the agricultural revolution that humans went through. And just talk me through why that was important, but also how that's seen in the tooth record, if you like.
Clearly, it's important from the sort of ecological perspective that we've been discussing here, because it sort of marks the point where we go from a part of nature to becoming apart from nature. We effectively take control of that buffet table. We decide what goes on the table. It's no longer nature. And the ability to have a more stable and predictable source of food obviously had its advantages. It allowed us to grow into larger numbers. There's a lot of debate as to why it happened and what drove it and the relationship between population size and the development of agriculture and sedentism and so forth. But for our purposes, it was clearly something that was key and was very important. And we can see it in the teeth. Not so much in the shapes of the teeth, not so much in the sizes of the teeth, but oftentimes in the oral health issues, dental disease, for example, gum disease, for example. These things take off with the agricultural revolution.
That's interesting, because you said that in other animals you don't see the kind of crowded teeth, the terrible cavities and all the rest of it that you see in humans. Is that down to this? Is that down to the fact that we underwent this revolution?
I think the Industrial Revolution probably had more of an effect than the Agricultural Revolution. I would imagine that if we go through a list of things with your listeners, so how many of your listeners have lower front teeth that are crowded together, have had impacted wisdom teeth or had them removed? How many of your listeners had their upper front teeth jutting out in front of their lower front teeth? These are not normal.
According to Peter, researchers today are looking at the teeth of all different types of communities, from fisher people in Japan to pastoralists to hunter-gatherers, agriculturalists, and industrialized communities. What those studies tell us is that across the world, people have unique and distinctive patterns of microscopic wear on their teeth.
I work with a group of hunter-gatherers, the last remaining hunter-gatherers in Africa called the Hadza. And I work with their mouths. And when I have them open their mouths, their teeth look very different from yours and mine, right? They've got three molar teeth, including the wisdom teeth, in full occlusion. They're working. They're wonderful. The lower front teeth are all perfectly aligned. They're not squished together. The upper front teeth come into direct tip-to-tip contact with the lower front teeth. They don't have this sort of scissors bite that most of the rest of us have. Most mammals have three beautiful molars. Most mammals have a beautiful arch in the front of their mouth. Most mammals have their upper front teeth coming into direct contact with their lower front teeth. What makes us different? This is a really cool example of the way evolution works and how our diets today are not properly matched with the diets we evolved to eat.
How do you see the shape and the function of our teeth changing as we evolve as humans now?
Well, not a fortune teller. And evolution's not directed, so it's going to be difficult to know what our teeth are going to look like in 10,000 years and a million years from now if we're still here. Whatever will lead to the production of more babies is going to be what drives the shapes of our teeth.
Special thanks this week to Peter Ungar. If you want to learn more about his research, we'll include a link to his book on the Guardian website. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
Great podcasts from The Guardian. Just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.